I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
From the Society for Nautical Research, in partnership with Lloyd's Register Foundation, I'm Sam Willis, and this is the Mariner's Mirror podcast, the world's number one podcast dedicated to all of maritime history. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Mariner's Mirror podcast. Today, we end our mini-series on maritime China with an episode on the Maritime Silk Road. Now, you may think that this is a fairly straightforward subject. Its name implies it was a maritime route by which silk was transported abroad from China. But as you will discover today, it is far, far more complicated than that. And I think far more interesting as a result. It's a topic that links us with Asia and Europe's deep past, till right up to the present day, and to China's strategic global positioning. I'm lucky to have sailed on a number of the routes we discuss for a National Geographic documentary, down the coast of China, past Vietnam to the Gulf of Thailand, on to Singapore and beyond to the Malacca Straits, and then out into the Indian Ocean and the numerous trade routes that open up. And so I was particularly pleased to balance my practical experience with a bit of proper education by talking with none other than Tansen Sen, director of the Center for Global Asia and professor of history at New York University in Shanghai. He specializes in Asian history and religions and has special scholarly interests in India-China interactions, Indian Ocean connections, and Buddhism. As ever, I hope you enjoy listening to him as much as I enjoyed talking with him. Here is a man who has truly met the considerable challenge of understanding how different nations and cultures interact in both past and present. It's the far-sighted Tansen. First of all, Tansen, let me say thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you, Sam. It's great to talk to you about maritime history.
So the Maritime Silk Road, the phrase the Maritime Silk Road, is surprisingly complicated. What do you think it refers to?
I think it's a creation, it's a constructed idea that comes from the Silk Road idea that was invented by this German geographer in the 19th century, and it became very popular, especially among the Chinese and the Japanese, and they wanted to recreate that in the maritime world, which I argue is perhaps not appropriate because the maritime world is hugely complicated. And perhaps no one term really can define it, because it's not just silk that was being traded. There were many other commodities, many other things going on. And the fact that it was a route is also very complicated, because there are many segments and routes across the Indian Ocean, South China Sea, East China Sea. So I think that's why it's a constructed term, trying to bring everything together. But it really comes out of this, I would say, nationalist idea, both in Japan initially and then in China, to connect themselves to the larger Indian Ocean world.
Mm. What sort of period did that happen? When did the Japanese and the Chinese decide to kind of do this?
So it started in the 1960s by this Japanese scholar called Misugu Takatoshi, who actually traveled the other direction that you were traveling. In your trips, he traveled from Japan to Turkey. And during his voyages all the way to Turkey, he saw Chinese ceramics And he later became one of the leading experts on Chinese porcelain. And he, in 1965, created this term initially in Japanese, but then translated into English as the Maritime Silk Road. So he pointed out in his book, published in 65, and later he was part of the NHK filming of various kinds of maritime-related documentaries, that it's not just about silk, because he himself was a scholar of ceramics, but he said that this is one way of propagating this idea that there is something that connects the maritime world. So he was the person who I have argued invented this term, Maritime Silk Road, and the concept behind it. But in China, it comes about in the 1980s, and the Chinese scholars, one in particular called Chen Yan, from Peking University, who then coined this term, not knowing that the Japanese had already started talking about it. So for him, he was the one who was inventing it. For him, this guy was a Burmese scholar. He studied Burmese language, Burmese history, and he was interested in looking initially at the route that connected China to India through Burma. Before he started using this term, Maritime Silk Road, he actually coined this term called the Southwestern Silk Road, which connected China to India through Burma. And then in 1981, he became interested in the maritime world. And at a very important conference, he then proposed this term called Maritime Silk Road in 1981.
And how did the sort of politics of China in the 1980s affect this? Because there's a growing sense of national identity, and it all kind of builds from this period, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's quite interesting because 1981 is just a few years after China started opening up. So the Chinese leader, Deng Xiaoping, had proposed this open-door policy. And one of the parts of this open-door policy was to connect with the maritime world. So the idea of the Maritime Silk Road then became very closely connected, especially among intellectuals first, and then in the mid-80s among the Chinese politicians, about China going out to the seas. And that became part of ways in which they created this narrative that going out is something good, and Maritime Silk Road is harmonious, peaceful, and China, when it's going out, is not a threat. So it became a way in which to project the soft image of China as it engaged with the world after the Cultural Revolution ended and the open door policy started. So we see in the literature, when the open door policy is usually discussed, the Maritime Silk Road will be brought up as a way in which China is connecting to the larger world.
It's interesting that the Chinese were then looking back to an earlier period of the Chinese, I'm thinking of the Zhonghe voyages, yes, here, going out and exploring the world. Do you think that they cared about how accurate their understanding of history was?
No, I think that never was the case. I think accuracy was problematic. But the linking of the Maritime Silk Road to Zhonghe actually starts when they celebrate the 580th anniversary of the voyages, which took place in 1405 and continued until 1433. And it was a way in which to say that at one point, China was a maritime power, but the power part was different from what the European colonizers did. China, according to them, in the 15th century, really did not occupy, colonize the places that Zhonghe, this Ming dynasty admiral, went to. So China was a maritime power, but used the power to create diplomatic engagements with the Indian Ocean world, rather than use military power. And the Maritime Silk Road was a depiction of that kind of a harmonious Chinese way of connecting to the world. So yes, since 1985, Zhonghe and the Maritime Silk Road became really very much entwined in the narratives, both by the state and by the intellectuals.
It's fascinating, isn't it? How does the relationship fit now between China's political ideas and the history trying to back it up? Do you academics have to kind of fit into this awkward position?
Yeah, I think especially with the Belt and Road Initiative, it has become more integrated into the state narrative of China's maritime engagements in the past and the present. So that's the reason why when we are talking about the narrative, the historical narrative of Belt and Road Initiative, which includes the Zheng He voyages, it includes the use of Maritime Silk Road, the attempts to create it as a World Heritage listing, a shared World Heritage thing, we have to be very careful about it because the use of historical narratives, and I've argued with the case of Zheng He himself, that these voyages were actually not that peaceful. We see evidence of use of military power. Almost every expedition, and he went on seven expeditions, carried about 20,000 plus soldiers, some of the most advanced weaponry, some of the largest ships. And there are records of Zheng He and his soldiers engaging in actually changing regimes. That happens in Southeast Asia, it happens in South Asia. So, you know, if we as historians look at those voyages, then we have to point out the Chinese historical records themselves indicate otherwise, that these voyages were not all peaceful and harmonious.
Yeah. It's interesting you bring up the Belt and Road Initiative. That's clearly such an important part. And it's a slightly confusing name, isn't it? Because the road in the Belt and Road Initiative refers to the sea. And the belt refers to the land.
Yes.
Tell us about, I suppose, the pressure on historians that arose from this sudden, the arrival of the Belt and Road Initiative, because it's a new phenomenon, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, so it's a hugely economic agenda of the state, right? So 2013, when the Chinese leader Xi Jinping started this, actually he started with the belt idea. So it was initially one belt, one road that he proposed first in Central Asia, and then the road idea he proposed in Indonesia the same year. And at that point, the narrative was not clear what exactly this initiative was. And gradually it became from one belt, one road to Belt and Road Initiative. Yes, the belt was this economic belt that existed across the, let's say, the steppe route and the Silk Roads, the land Silk Roads. The road, I think, most likely he was talking about the Maritime Silk Roads road, all right? So I think that's how the word came about, right? Why the road? Because the Maritime Silk Road idea, the term, had already existed before 2013. And it did not make sense beyond China's economic policy at that time, 2013, which became a political policy as well, because this was not going to the U.S. as such. It was going to Africa and later on to Europe. Japan was not involved. So it became a hugely political issue. And in order to address that political issue, the Chinese started bringing in culture. So it became economic, political, and cultural aspect that now are three important, you can say, legs of Belt and Road Initiative.
It's fascinating, isn't it? So you've got the politicians who have their own concept of history, which they use to their own ends. Then you've got academics who are being a bit more cautious and saying, whoa, we need to actually talk about what really happened. What about everyone else? Do the Chinese have a keen sense of their own maritime history or not?
Yeah, so they have. But before I go and talk about that, I should point out that it's not just about the Chinese. You know, this book called 1421 that Gavin Manzes wrote, which argued that the Chinese had discovered the world. And this is totally a made-up history, which was designated, unfortunately, as a non-fiction by the Library of Congress. And Gavin Manzes made a lot of money propagating that idea, which is totally useless. But that got accepted in many places, including by the Chinese leadership initially. Right? So it's not just the Chinese government or the Chinese scholars who are using their ways of looking at history to construct something they want to propagate. But it's others as well, and there are various disciples of Gavin Manzes running around arguing that the Chinese went to U.S. before Christopher Columbus did discover the entire world. So that I think is a caution that we should have. You see in my background, there's a 1421 book there.
I have one by my desk as well. And whenever I want to entertain myself, I read all about dogs in Brazil or something, and how that proves the Chinese came.
Yeah. So I think this is an issue that. That we have to be aware of and point out as historians that, you know, there are problems in the interpretation. That's what the historians do. And we are not always right. We have to acknowledge that interpretation continues, right? People come up with new sources and there are new ways of looking at the maritime history. And the Chinese were aware of that. But it becomes complicated in China because of the colonial experience that the Chinese had since the Opium War, which was a maritime engagement between China and the colonial powers, the British in particular, in the 1839-40s. So their concept of maritime history, you can say, comes from that kind of engagement with the colonial power. So when they look back at their maritime history, they are thinking about the 19th century experience. But, you know, there are other Chinese scholars who are looking at archaeology and what kind of evidence there is with regard to the maritime engagement. And initially, there's very little. And because China was mostly engaged with the northern parts of their empire, Central Asia, Mongolia. And so the Chinese engagement with the maritime world actually starts in around 1000 CE, when the Chinese start developing their own ships that can go into the seas. And that is something that they recognize, but still there is a view, and this is part of the nationalist way of creating this 5,000 years of Chinese history, idea within China that, no, China has been engaged with the maritime world, with their ships, long time before that. And this is something that has been ingrained into the Chinese scholarship, and it's very difficult to argue, even with Chinese scholars, that, you know, you can't really say that because the evidence of Chinese presence in the Indian Ocean is totally lacking, right? Mm. So we don't see Chinese ships arriving in India, for example, before 1000 CE, same in Southeast Asia. And then it relates to the shipbuilding industry in China as well. Did the Chinese really have the technology to build ocean-going ships? As you know, these ships are constructed very differently. The wooden planks are very different because of the salty waters of the oceans. So where did that technology come from? And it's clearly Southeast Asian influence that results in the building of these ocean-going ships that happens in the 10th, 11th century only.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah. It's interesting talking about that area, particularly the Indian Ocean, because the narrative we often get is so China-centric.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about that and whether it's fair?
It's not fair, but I think we understand that, because it's not just China again that does it. Other countries have done it. Oman, for example, does it very often. India does it. That the long history of its maritime heritage. And I think China has been good in doing that for one particular reason, which is they have lots of historical documents, unlike, let's say, Oman or India, because their historical documents go back to the pre-Common Era times. And then you can find records of Southeast Asia, and the information is most likely coming from foreign travelers, foreign traders. But they have, nonetheless, records. And those records are what, you know, scholars have to really look at and interpret. And you can't take those records on their face value. That's what historians have to do, is to not just read the records, but try to analyze, deconstruct those records. And once you start deconstructing those records, then you can see the problems in the records, even though they are huge in number, right? So I think those who lack a knowledge of classical Chinese perhaps would be stuck with one kind of interpretation that people are making, and are not looking at the original sources and try to decipher what those records indicate. But one of the reasons, as you said, for the China-centric views of the maritime world is that they have the records, and they can use it to play that role of Sinocentrism and say, look, we have the records and we think this is the way. And this became an argument actually between Chinese scholars and Japanese scholars with regard to the maritime Silk Road idea, because the person who invented this term in China, Chen Yan, would say, why are the Japanese interpreting our sources? We Chinese have the sources. We should be writing the history of the maritime Silk Road and not the Japanese. So Japanese also read Chinese characters, so they were the ones not only reading it, but also interpreting it. So it's very interesting to see how the Japanese interpretation of same sources differ from how the Chinese were doing it. And this combination that I mentioned earlier between what was happening in China politically and this idea of maritime Silk Road propagated by Chinese intellectuals became so intertwined that the Sinocentrism idea concept really took off from that, because these intellectuals also wanted China to open up.
I think it's fair for us to say that it's unlikely that we are suddenly going to discover some new ancient Chinese or Japanese sources which are going to change our perspective on all of this, which suggests to me that the future battleground over this is going to be maritime archaeology. Yeah. Is there a sense of that in the maritime community?
Yes, and a part of the Belt and Road Initiative is to invest in maritime archaeology, and the Chinese have really developed maritime archaeology also since the 1990s, and they realized that as part of their argument on the maritime Silk Road, which said, you know, Chinese were there first, and the Chinese were visiting different places in the Indian Ocean, they think maritime archaeology is what can provide them the evidence. So one of the things they have been doing in Kenya, for example, actually the whole Eastern African coast, is trying to find the ships that belong to Cheng He. And with all the records that we have about Cheng He, we do not have any evidence about his ships. So one of the things that the Chinese government has been doing is to invest a lot of money in maritime archaeology. And you would know this because states lack funding for maritime archaeology. It costs a lot. The Chinese government seems to have that money to invest in maritime archaeology. And on one hand, this has really helped the field of maritime archaeology in China. But on the other hand, it has again become very much part of the Chinese nationalism, China-centric ideas of the maritime world. It is being done to promote the idea that the Chinese were engaged in the maritime world from early on. So you see this in a number of different places. You see it in South China Sea as well, where it's connected to the issue of sovereignty, territorial claims, and so forth. So in South China Sea, you have a number of different shipwrecks. And many of these shipwrecks have Chinese goods, porcelain, for example. But the ships themselves were perhaps constructed elsewhere and perhaps run by people who are not Chinese. But the Chinese government has claimed that if the commodities in the ships are Chinese, it's a Chinese shipwreck. So, you know, this becomes a whole issue about whose ownership here about the underwater archaeology. So UNESCO has been dealing with this, whose heritage, right? I mean, if you have a shipwreck, and this is a controversial issue with the UNESCO, who can then claim this shipwreck that is discovered in South China Sea, right? So I think that gets into a complicated issue about heritage making, claim to territories, creating new narratives of history. So I think it's maritime archaeology, underwater archaeology is very, very interesting, I think, going forward.
Yeah, you mentioned Kenya. I've actually been to Malindi and I've dived on a wreck which was supposedly Chinese, but it was not. It was Portuguese. They discovered it was Portuguese shortly after they thought it was Chinese. So Africa's obviously a hotspot. That clearly matters. Is there a kind of a ranking of important places for the Chinese to prove that they identify with? I'm thinking of maybe Cambodia or whatever it might be. Do you get a sense of that, a priority?
Oh, clearly South China Sea is priority number one. And it's not just Cambodia, but also the maritime world of Southeast Asia, Indonesia, Philippines. This part, because it overlaps with the territorial claims and disputes with Vietnam, with Philippines. So yes, South China Sea, which is right next to the Chinese coastal region, is priority number one, right? So then you move to the Indian Ocean world, and that extends from eastern coast of Africa all the way to India and beyond India, reaching South China Sea. But in the eastern coast of Africa is, I would say, number two, because they are trying to reach out to that faraway land, connect to Africa both economically and politically. So again, this idea that China is not a threat, we are harmonious, peaceful, we can help you with archaeology. So it's a public diplomacy kind of a thing they are doing in Africa. And then the third, I would say, is around India. So Sri Lanka, Pakistan, Burma, Bangladesh, I think they are trying to develop some kind of archaeological aspect there as well. And more interestingly, I think, is what they are trying to do in Saudi Arabia with the Middle East also.
Yeah.
And I think they are funding various archaeological programs in Saudi Arabia and the Persian Gulf. And I think that has to relate to the Islamic countries, oil as a resource. But it's very well integrated, I would say, the political agenda, the economic agenda, and the cultural agenda of the Chinese government.
Yeah, it was interesting what you're saying about the Persian Gulf. I think that's really going to change, because the one thing that we all know is going to happen is that the oil is going to run out at some point.
Yeah.
And tourism is a really important source of money to replace that, which means there's a real focus on those areas who have a significant history, a fascinating history all around there, going back to the Neolithic. But a lot of the maritime world has been very little explored. Do you know of any work going on there in the maritime world at the moment?
In the Persian Gulf, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think there are a number of people studying both archaeologies, starting from, you know, Oman outwards. Oman has been also investing money on maritime studies. And Yemen, which before the conflict there, I think was quite important as far as the Hadrami network was concerned. So there's a scholar at Duke called Enseng Ho, who really mapped the Hadrami network from Yemen to Southeast Asia. And that kind of study on that region it has been going on by different scholars, looking at the art historical part, the archaeological part. Saudi Arabia is also interested in looking at its own maritime heritage. So one thing the Chinese have done has made all these countries interested in their maritime heritage. How do they connect to the Chinese maritime Silk Road? Here, let me the Chinese government would say, let us have this exhibition about how Saudi Arabia connected to China, and we'll do the exhibition in the Persian Gulf in China so that, you know, you understand your heritage as well and how you are connected to the Maritime Silk Road. They do that in Sri Lanka. So these kinds of exhibitions, performances are a very important part of bringing other nations into this narrative of the Maritime Silk Road, because they are offering their own maritime heritage as well. So Oman does it, Saudi Arabia does it. And so it's an interesting way of connecting from the other side to China.
Yeah, well, it's a wonderful place to leave it. Tansen, thank you very much indeed for your time. Fascinating. I'm definitely going to come back to you and talk to you again.
Sure, sure. And let me know when you're coming to China and we can get you to Shanghai.
Now, thank you all so much for listening. If you have enjoyed this episode, do please check out our other episode on maritime China. We've explored a fabulous number of topics. My favourite, I think, being the episode in which I interview Arthur Jones, a very good friend of mine. He's also the director of The Six, a documentary made about the six Chinese survivors of the Titanic disaster. Please remember that this podcast comes from both the Society for Nautical Research and the Lloyd's Register Foundation. You can find the Society for Nautical Research at snr.org.uk, where I would encourage you all to join up. It's a fabulous way not only of finding out all about maritime history from the very best in the business, but it's a brilliant way of meeting people with similar interests. Now, the Lloyd's Register Foundation's History and Education Centre are up to all sorts of wonderful projects. Most recently, their wonderful, wonderful thing. It's called Maritime Innovation in Miniature, and we've been filming the world's best ship models using the very latest camera equipment. It's absolutely astonishing. Best way to find that is simply to Google Maritime Innovation in Miniature. And we'll be back soon. Cheerio, guys.
Save big money on exterior wall lights now at Menards. Find your style with Patriot Lighting. Exterior lights enhance the look of your home. Choose from over 50 options from Patriot Lighting. Now through May 19th, get $10 instant savings on a single qualifying purchase of $100 or more on in-stock outdoor wall lights. Check out our entire selection of outdoor lights and see the rest of our deals happening now on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.